Thank you. Be seated.
Court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Austin Hill Country Realty versus Palisades Plaza.
May it please the court. Your Honor, this case gives this court an opportunity to clarify an issue in landlord that has been confused since 1988. The specific issue before this court is whether or not the tenant in this case and the guarantors were entitled to an instruction to the jury in question number two on damages as to mitigation.
Are you arguing also on behalf of Messrs. Smith and Jones?
Your Honor, we're collectively arguing on behalf of, the answer to your question is yes, although at the trial court I did not specifically represent those two parties.
So I'll direct the question to you, whether, what is your response to respondent's statement that they did not plead mitigation and admitted that the amount of damages was correct?
First of all, Your Honor, I would make it clear that the clients I represented did plead mitigation. Second of all, evidence
Just for clarification, tenant. Everybody else in the case.
Yes, sir.
It was petitioner's side.
Yes, it was the tenant and Ms. Hill. That pleading was clearly before the court. Evidence was admitted without objection as to mitigation on at least three to four different areas in this case. The law is fairly clear in Texas that even if a party does admit certain issues, that if evidence does come in without admission, or excuse me, without objection, that the jury can still consider the evidence, and in this case could consider the admission, and in fact could also consider the other evidence.
Well, so even in this case, if we were to agree with you that the law should be, as you argue it should be, and that the instruction should have been given, is this harmful error, given the jury's verdict?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So how can you demonstrate that it's harmful error?
I believe it's harmful because this jury was not allowed to focus on the specific issue of whether or not the tenant mitigated. They sat back, and we may not, even though we know that their number corresponded to 9.5 months, we don't know what happened inside that jury. But what I do know is this jury was not allowed to be focused on what that number should be had they reasonably mitigated.
What did you argue for the jury?
Your Honor, I argued, and I'll have to be candid with the court, I did argue that those numbers should be less and that there were reasons for it. But the jury was not instructed.
What number did you argue to the jury?
I didn't give the jury a specific number.
Did you argue point their direction to the testimony that they apparently followed in coming up with this number?
No, I did not point them to 9.5 months. And I pointed to a lesser amount, and I'll be candid with the court in that regard.
Was the argument recorded?
No, sir, it was not. One of the things, though, that I would point out to the court is the Alexander case, which we've cited in our brief from the El Paso Court of Appeals, was a case where mitigation instruction was not given. And that was held to be reversible error, and that is after an opinion, and in light of the opinion of the court that was cited by the plaintiffs, the Island Recreational Development case. This jury was not allowed to take into consideration the distinctions, or at least was not directed by the court. And we had asked the court very clearly for that instruction, and in fact, you can sense the confusion in the trial court because the instruction originally was in the charge to the jury. When we came back right before we argued it, and you'll see this in the last section of the statement of facts, the court made the decision that the law, in fact, did not allow for mitigation, and makes the statement as a bit of a forecast, potentially and hopefully, that this may be the case to clarify the law. It is our position that there are two subparts to what we brought the court to consider. The first subpart is that the landlord in this case elected a contractual remedy. And separate and apart from the law of property, which has given us the feudal system, which has created the lack of mitigation. This landlord chose a contractual remedy and, in fact, declared an anticipatory breach of a lease before the tenant ever took possession, and then elected a contractual remedy. This court, in 1988, in the concurring opinion in the Brown case, looked at the employment advisor's case. There are, as best I can tell, three cases out there that deal with this subject. The employment advisor's case, we contend, is the correct law, as Justice Phil Garland said in his opinion, that had he and this court had the opportunity to review it, that they would have found that if a landlord uses a contractual remedy, that they are bound to use the converse, that they have a duty to mitigate. I happen to think that if we change the facts in this case and turn things around, I can highlight the inequity in the law that we have right now. Let us assume that rather than landlord declaring tenant an anticipatory breach, that landlord did not finish out the space, and tenant, which has a business, was not allowed to go into that space to continue running the business. And the facts are in this case that they had subleased their old space. Now, the law that we have cited, specifically the Burge case, says that when a landlord breaches a lease and a tenant has lost business damages, that the tenant has to mitigate its damages. So right now, if we follow the Burge case in Texas, had we flipped and reversed the roles in this case, the tenant would be under a duty to mitigate its damages, but the inequity is that in this instance, the landlord does not, according to the law that the trial court used, does not have a duty to mitigate its damages.
Counsel, I'm sure you noticed from the opposing counsel's brief that the legislature has been very active in coming up with legislation in this area. Why is this not a policy issue best left to the legislature to decide as opposed to the Supreme Court imposing what it believes its policy position should be?
This is a damage issue. It has to do with contracts. In today's society, parties contract with each other all the time, and that's the precept, the concept that other states have used to distinguish themselves from the old rule, saying that we have parties that are capable of contracting with each other and do so on a very elevated basis.
With that being the case, why would the best policy not be to leave it to the parties to decide, who are both sophisticated commercial parties, to decide whether or not to include or exclude a mitigation clause in the contract? Instead of us just by law imposing it in all situations.
Well, if we go that far, though, in this case, then it will affect contract law across the board, which would then, I think, create an argument that there is no duty to mitigate in any breach of contract case unless the parties had contemplated up front and included a clause that says a defaulting or a party claiming default has to mitigate its damages. That is not the current law. And in fact, I don't know of a situation in Texas where the legislature has gone forward and said in any breach of contract case, then there is a duty to mitigate. And so I would strongly contend, Your Honor, that it is not something that is needed to be resolved by the legislature. This, in the first part of our argument that we're making, is a contract argument. It is a common law principle. It is a principle designed to lessen waste and to promote efficiency.
Has the Texas legislature said with regard to residential tenancies that the landlord has the obligation to mitigate?
Your Honor, to my knowledge, there is no statute or reference from the legislature in any way on this issue regarding residential tenancies or commercial tenancies.
In order for me to make clear there's harmful error here, would you tell me, if you had been allowed to introduce your evidence, because most of it came, the jury had been given an instruction that would have allowed them to focus on this evidence, what would the verdict have been had the jury accepted all of your evidence? And how would that have differed from the verdict that was actually entered, that the individual defendants say, in the standard?
Had I been able to say to this jury, you have been instructed by the trial judge not to award damages that could have been mitigated against. I contend that this verdict could have been and might have been zero. And the reason I contend that is because of the evidence. For instance, the testimony that we have in our brief, because after the tenant was put into anticipatory breach, two of the guarantors came forward with an offer to take over that space, run it in exactly the same style, and run it as a franchise, and a real estate office, and the testimony was that they were not allowed to do that. And Mr. Bishop's question at the time tried to get Mr. Grainer to admit, and even though the court asked him to answer the question, he would not admit, although came very close, that there wouldn't have been a dime's worth of damage had he been able to put or allow two of the guarantors to go in and take that space. I was not given the opportunity to say to this jury, you have to disregard damages that they contend they have if they could have mitigated against it. That was just one form of the lack of mitigation. The other guarantor, Ms. Hill, also made an offer, and that, admittedly, that offer was more disputed at trial because it ultimately was pulled back when not accepted, and there was an issue of fact over when that happened. But what we also proved, Your Honor, was that this landlord stopped its normal advertising program in the Flick Report, which is a commercial Austin area report to brokers, and they stopped it the very month that the tenant was put in anticipatory breach. And it was not started up again for 9.5 months, and was started the very month that the tenant from another portion of the building, Tipton Cole, moved into the tenant space. And then the evidence was that they advertised the vacant space where Tipton Cole was to try and find a tenant. The only explanation we got at trial was that there was a dispute with the Flick Report. I was not allowed, nor was Mr. Bishop allowed, at trial, to focus and direct the jury with regard to the law. We did the best we could under the circumstances, and as far as the trial judge would let us go, but we were not specifically allowed to inform the jury of the law, which is what we had pled, what we proved was part of discovery, and which was our right to do so.
And in that was not the state of law, though, at the time of trial.
Your Honor, at the time of the trial, we had five justices of the Supreme Court stating in the Brown opinion that it should be the law. And the courts after the Brown opinion, including the appellate court in this case, felt constrained to accept that as the pronouncement of this court. With respect to the employment advisors part of the case, the issue of whether or not they chose to use a contract theory, I contend was the law, although I have to admit, as the appellate court in this case cited, that there is contrary authority in the White opinion. There are two for me and one against me. But I cited and contended that Justice Kilgarland was correct, that if you as a landlord make a choice to avoid suing on the lease but use a contract theory, anticipatory breach, which was the only theory submitted to the jury, and was the theory from day one in this case that was used by landlords, that employment advisors simply applied. So I don't know if I've answered your question.
You say at page 5 of your brief that there may be a distinction between mitigation in all situations or mitigation, quote, when the landlord uses a contractual theory to obtain damages. What's that distinction?
Well, the distinction is that if this court holds on to the feudal theory of property law, that if a landlord in today's society elects to use a contractual theory, and i.e. use the common law to assert his or her remedies, that mitigation applies.
How else do you do it?
I'm sorry?
How else does the landlord do it?
Well, the landlord has the right under property law to sit back and could, in fact, sue every month for lost rent, could sit back and not do anything, wait to the term of the end of the term of the lease and file a lawsuit.
And the tenant could move back in at any time.
Tenant
could move back in at any time under that theory.
Under that theory, conceivably, the idea is that that piece of property has been conveyed to the tenant for the duration of that time, and it's the tenant's problem if the tenant abandons or leaves it.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Kenneth Luner will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. I believe the issue before you today is quite narrow. It is not should we change the law on mitigation. The issue is even if the law had been changed at the time this case was argued before the trial court, still would the plaintiffs in the case be entitled to an issue on mitigation or an instruction on mitigation? I submit to you they would not. And I submit to you that the failure to include that instruction was harmless error, as I've outlined in my brief. I think you're familiar with the Island Recreational Development Court court case, which sets out the standard for a harmless error. That is, the error must be reasonably calculated and probably did result in the rendition of an improper judgment. Now, given the facts of this case and given what the trial court said, how in the world could we conclude that the failure to give a mitigation instruction resulted in an improper verdict in this case? Consider the most important bit of evidence, I think, which I believe Judge Phillips alluded to, which was that two of the personal defendants who were in paramateria with one of the other individuals and the corporation, which was primarily liable. They all had the exact same interest in this case. Two of the defendants were going to be individually, personally liable if a judgment was rendered against them. Nevertheless, those two individuals admitted that the amount of damages was $29,000. And they didn't qualify their admission and say, it is only $29,000 before you consider mitigation. They said, it's $29,000.
How did they, where in the record is that admission?
That is, in the statement of facts, we sent written admissions to the parties. They failed to answer. They were represented by counsel at all times, and this failure to answer was, 9 months before the trial. And we read that to the jury. Immediately, it was the first bit of evidence they heard.
This property was released to the other tenant in the following August, correct?
Yes, sir, nine and a half months later.
And isn't it true that on one or two different occasions, two of the individuals sought to rent or move back in? I think one was in January and one was some other month, which would have reduced the amount of damages.
There were two discussions. At the outset, defendants Smith and Jones, who had split off from Hill, approached the property manager for my client and expressed an interest in renting it, at which point, and the testimony is in the record, my client said, fine, if you can just give me a letter or something from defendant Hill letting me know it's okay with her, I'll be happy to enter into discussions with you. There was no written offer. There was nothing more than that. They couldn't get any instruction from Hill. You need to appreciate the context this was taken in. We have a corporate tenant. On the other hand, we have the party saying that their franchise was run under an oral partnership agreement. You have great animosity among the parties. They admit even when they entered into the lease, they were already in default under their franchise agreement. They're cutting phone lines. They're fighting among one another. My client didn't want to get in the middle of that. So he said, just let me know that it's okay with the other one and I won't get sued and I'll lease to you. But that's where that went. If I may, the second one was Defendant Hill and another third party that has nothing to do with this case did in fact submit a written offer, and the evidence is in the record that they withdrew that offer, so it was never acted on. We could not have acted upon it.
Would you elaborate on your statement that even if the trial court were inclined to give the instruction, it should not have been given in this case? I assume that's because you said there was no evidence?
Yes, ma'am. For mitigation, there's a two-prong test in this case, or in this state. It's not just show evidence to the jury that the plaintiff failed to mitigate its damages. It is also show the specific dollar amount by which the damages would have been decreased or were increased because of this failure. There is no evidence. Justice Phillips asked Mr. Weisbart about that a minute ago. What is the exact amount? There is absolutely no evidence of the exact amount by which any efforts to mitigate or not to mitigate would have reduced the amount of damages the plaintiffs incurred. And I can cite you to the cases on that point. Your own pattern jury charges reflect several cases on that point. So they shouldn't have been entitled to an instruction in any event. And
Mr. Lerner,
yes, sir.
Justice Heck asked opposing counsel at the outset about the admission on the damages, and his response was, well, evidence was admitted on mitigation elements without objection. Is that correct?
Well, yes, it was, only because that evidence went to so many other issues. I could not possibly have objected if I wanted to.
Does that take away or vitiate your position that that was a judicial admission, so that by not having an instruction, the tenants could not argue that that was a reduction in the amount of the 9.5 months that the property was vacant?
No, sir, I would make two responses to you. First of all, to follow up on what I was just saying to Justice Owen, even if there is evidence in the record of my client's alleged failure to mitigate their damages, there is no evidence of the precise dollar amount that would have made a difference.
Well, wasn't there a offer by two of them to do the same lease?
Well, we had.
Which was not accepted?
Well, there was nothing to accept.
And if he had an exception, couldn't he argue they would have paid the same thing, so it was zero, which was his position?
Well, perhaps he could have argued that. That never was argued. I mean, there wasn't anything that my client could have accepted. They came to him and said, can we enter into some negotiations? He said, give me permission from Hill to do so, and I will. We weren't at the point where we had a binding offer that, had he said yes, we would have triggered it and go from there. The second thing, I guess, is just that at that time, as this inspector indicated, the law was, and perhaps still is, there was no duty to mitigate. There should not have been an instruction in this case under the state of the law at that time. But again, even if you assume there was a duty, can we say that this was reversible error? Given the admissions of two parties, we say that the damages are correct. How can we say the jury probably rendered an improper verdict? It just doesn't stand up to any further investigation. With regard to whether or not the law should or should not be changed, I think we've addressed that sufficiently in our brief. As I pointed out, the courts are not making a wholesale rush across the nation to change the law. I'm not advocating that we maintain a feudal system. We have the law in effect at least for, well, perhaps for all tenants, certainly for commercial tenants, as do many other courts in the state, and I submit that the law should remain the same.
Would you articulate the basis for your argument that this is a matter for the legislature and not for this court?
Yes, sir. I guess two things come into play in that. First of all, as I pointed out in my brief, the legislature has been so active in this area, beginning in 1981 when they first start writing about landlord-tenant laws, then in 1983 when they codify that in the property code and they set out a specific section for residential landlord-tenant law. And that section, you might be aware, is probably 7 to 10 times longer than the remaining portions. The legislature has come back in 83, 89, 93. They've been very active in this area, particularly with regard to residential tenancies, but also with regard to commercial tenancies. And throughout all of that, they've not addressed this situation.
Well, what about his argument that this is a contract situation as opposed to a property right situation?
Well, with regard to whether the legislature should get into that, The legislature has looked at the leases with residential tenancies, and they say you have to make certain disclosures now. You have to have certain other things, pardon me, other things in your lease about, for example, smoke alarms and other things. There's no reason why the legislature can't legislate on contractual issues. It makes no sense. I said there were two prongs. The other thing I would like to point out is, if this court now were inclined to change the law, you said we're going to follow what the trend is. Well, there is no trend. As I pointed out in our brief, states and legislatures across this nation have taken a variety of approaches to this issue. Some say across the board, we require mitigation. Some say across the board, we do not require mitigation. Some say we require mitigation only for residential tenancies. Some say we require mitigation if the parties have a lease that allows for mitigation. Some say we allow mitigation only if the landlord accepts the surrender and takes over the premises. With this variety of approaches, I just submit to you it would be a better forum to decide this issue in the legislature where the people, through their elected representatives, can decide the issue. I know you're capable of making the decision. I just suggest perhaps the legislature could also address it.
You argue that if we do change it, it shouldn't be retroactive.
Yes, sir.
Say a word about that.
Granted that you have the authority to go either way on that issue, the rules you've announced previously say that it should not, a rule would not be applied retroactively if it would be grossly unfair to do so if the parties didn't know and couldn't comport their conduct in anticipation of that law. At the time my clients entered into this lease and at the time they took all of their conduct, every court in this state had said there is no mitigation.
As well as all sorts of land, not just your client, but I suppose landlords all over the state.
Landlords all over this state. We can only speculate as to what sophisticated landlords and tenants do in this state. I mean, I can tell you what my practice is when I represent tenants, and I'm faced with the issue about whether or not there'll be mitigation, but that's an issue we all face on a day-to-day basis. May I also remind
you, this lease was 5 years after the Brown opinion.
Yes, sir.
You keep saying that. Maybe things have changed, but at that time there was no hint. There was some hint of disquietude in the Texas law from that opinion, was there not?
Indeed there was, but there were also the subsequent Court of Appeals opinions by Dallas Courts of Appeal and the Corpus Christi Courts of Appeal that said there is no mitigation. Until the Supreme Court gives us a little more clear indication, we're going to follow what we believe is the law. So, you know, what is a reasonable person out there to do? And particularly in this case, this is, if you're going to change the law, think about the facts in this case. You had three licensed real estate agents, three real estate professionals. They make their living buying and selling property and handling leases for other people. They're sophisticated people. They can certainly protect themselves. They can certainly bargain on their own behalf. And they didn't choose to say anything about mitigation in their lease, or they didn't choose to address that issue. You can certainly leave them exactly where they wanted to be, but exactly where they bargained for themselves to be. If there are no further questions, I'll give you back some of my time. Thank you for the opportunity.
May it please the court. We'll attempt to briefly address the issues that the court has expressed interest in. The first, it seems to me, is the harmless error. And I think it's vital to understand in the context of this case, my two clients, both before and after the declaration of anticipatory breach by the landlord, said we'll take the space under the same terms and conditions. We will tell you what to do about the leasehold improvements. the evidence, I think, is virtually undisputed that had the landlord elected to deal with my clients, there would not be, as the record discloses, one thin dime of damages. And that is just not testimony. There are letters, the record is replete with letters from my client who were trying to resolve this unfortunate fight with the other partner.
And why did they admit what the damages were?
They did not respond to the request for admissions. And that was certainly, in hindsight, poor judgment. I think there are at least two answers to that. The first, as phrased, it seems that the request for admissions were calling for admissions of fact, i.e. the amount of monthly rent and the length of time in which the property was vacant. It was not clear, at least at that time, nor made clear to the trial court that what counsel was really trying to do is to somehow get a legal admission of a legal conclusion, I suppose, or pure question of law. Secondly, as guarantors, Smith and Jones could never be liable in the absence of liability on the part of the actual tenant. They were merely guarantors under the lease. The tenant, REMAX, was carrying the ball and acting in a lead capacity. Now, I'm not going to try to pretend to the court that it was handled properly. There should have been an objection and an explanation. But throughout the trial, as evidenced by the fact that the court never did anything. The trial court never said anything about, well, isn't this deemed admitted? Why are we fighting over damages as to you two? Why are you here? No one ever considered until the appeal arose that there had been a deemed admission of a legal conclusion that the amount of damages that turned out to have been awarded by the jury was correct.
And why isn't there a failure to mitigate fatal to that position?
Again, because they're guarantors. They don't have to raise. The guarantors are entitled to go along, in essence, for a free ride. So they didn't even have to appear. They did, and they participated. But their liability is purely derivative of that of the tenant who did raise the
issue.
They
weren't primarily liable under their guarantors?
I beg your pardon?
Were they were not primarily liable under their guarantee?
The lease describes them as being guarantors under the lease. It'd be like guarantors of a note or any other obligation. So I think the issue of harmless error, it just doesn't exist here because the jury, under the charge of the court, was not permitted to decide the issue under what we contend is the correct legal theory.
Did REMAX plead mitigation?
Yes. It was pled and in fact was the subject of considerable controversy at the charge stage of the conference. As counsel said, and I don't know if this is disclosed by the record, but at one point the trial court decided to submit the instruction and then change his mind. So there wasn't any question about mitigation being in the case the whole time.
Even if the landlord sues on anticipatory breach and there should be mitigation in that in those circumstances?
That's my...
Should there be, if the landlord just chooses to sue month by month or at the end of the lease, where the tenant can come back at any time?
I think that this court crossed that bridge when the majority of the judges in Brown against Republic Bank. And we've had the discussion by Justice Phillips about should this be retroactive or not retroactive. And in Brown against Republic Bank, the Chief Justice there was dissenting from the result, but concurring in the proposition that mitigation should be Texas law. And specifically addressed that and said because this duty to mitigate represents a change in the law, the bank had no reason at trial to rebut the evidence of mitigation and therefore would reverse in the interest of justice under Mora against Shockwell rather than give retroactive application. So I suggest to the court when you have five judges of this court saying that this should be the law, including the Chief Justice saying we shouldn't apply it retroactively because it's not fair, you've given a fair hint. And the argument to the contrary and the argument, the holding of the Court of Appeals is, well, that's just pure dictum, which reminds me of many years ago when I was here.
Are you still answering the question?
Yes, sir. And I'm finishing. Someone said that to Judge Greenhill. I said, well, that was just dictum. And Judge Greenhill, then Chief Justice, said, but counsel, it was our dictum. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. We will now take one final recess for the final argument in a few minutes.